Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, as well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. Next week, world leaders will gather at the United Nations for a major summit on climate change. This Sunday, on September 21st, more than 100,000 people, including likely thousands of Vermonters on buses from numerous cities and towns around the state, are expected to attend the People's Climate March being held in New York City. Organizers say that the march will almost certainly be the largest rally about climate change in human history. We'll spend the hour talking about climate change and the many different phases of the movement to stop it. Later in the program today, we'll talk with Jonathan Lash, the president of Hampshire College, on why Hampshire has divested its endowment of fossil fuel stocks. We'll also speak with Clayton Thomas Mueller, a Canadian indigenous leader with the group Idle No More, on the struggle of Native people to stop the exploitation of their lands for tar sands and other resources. And we'll speak with Governor Peter Shumlin about what Vermont is doing about climate change and his views on fossil fuel divestment. We begin the hour with Bill McKibben, the Vermont author and activist and founder of the grassroots climate movement 350.org. Bill, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Hello, brother. How are you?
I'm doing great. You're already in New York, already getting ready for this march. You have written recently, quote, "We're tired of winning the argument and losing the fight." How will the People's Climate March this Sunday change that?
Well, it won't change it overnight. It's going to be an unbelievably grand occasion, I think. I've just come from the headquarters for the march where everybody's just, the buzz is crazy. I came down the Hudson Valley yesterday speaking in Albany and New Paltz and so on, and every place we went, they're just adding buses left and right. No place sending more people per capita than Vermont, I'm certain, and so many thanks to all the people like Maeve McBride and everybody else who have been rounding up buses for weeks. We're all going to march. It's all going to be really powerful. It's going to help, we think, take the zeitgeist here a little bit and shake it by the scruff of the neck. But it won't change it overnight. Movements never do. They keep building and building until such point as their power is, their reach and scope is large enough that those in power have to take notice. You never know quite when that's going to happen or quite what the triggering event's going to be. You just know that if you don't show up, if you don't build the movement, then it can never happen. I don't think we're going to see progress out of the UN meeting itself this week. I don't think Obama nor the Chinese nor the Indians nor any of the other big players are ready to move in any decisive way. But I do think that we're putting everyone on notice that there is a global movement of serious proportion demanding action. Not only will there be the largest climate demonstration in history in New York, and I think the largest political gathering of any kind in this country in many years, there will also be about 2,000 solidarity demonstrations in 150 countries worldwide. Some of them will be quite big, too, though not on this same scale, but they're all sending the same message. We're tired of fine words about all this stuff and ready for actual action.
Can you explain what this UN meeting is trying to accomplish or says it's going to accomplish?
The next big UN negotiating session is December 2015. That's the sort of follow-up to the Copenhagen meeting that ended in a fiasco and failure in 2009. So the UN Secretary General wanted everybody to come together in September of this year, all the world leaders about a year out from that meeting, to try and get them on the record kind of making commitments and things. So far, it doesn't look like many of them are going to do much. And the UN is getting increasingly impatient. We learned yesterday that Ban Ki-moon will come and march with us on Sunday, which will be a pretty remarkable turn of events. I'm sort of eager for the moment when the entire march is going to stop at about 1 o'clock and on the dot, and just make one big noise. Everybody's bringing musical instruments and whistles and air horns and whatever they got, because we're going to sound the climate alarm. And I'm sort of looking forward to seeing the Secretary General throwing back his head and letting out a yell too. I'm sure he's more frustrated than absolutely anybody else, having to deal with these guys day in and day out. But that frustration level is really high, and that's what we got to get across, that they're not only playing with fire on the planet, they're playing with fire politically, because this movement finally is reaching the scale it needs to.
Now, as I understand it, the march doesn't actually make demands and doesn't have speakers. This is
no
different.
No speakers. That may be its finest function. Somebody was worried. They said to me yesterday, what about Dr. King and his speech in 1963? I said, yes, that was a really amazing speech. And can you think of any other speeches from all the other rallies that there have ever been? I think Dr. King was probably the exception that proved the rule. And since we lack a Dr. King, this time it's a People's Climate March, and we're going to do the speaking with our presence, all of us. And the thing that will be most fascinating about this march, I think, is its incredible diversity. The climate movement, because climate change happens to everyone everywhere, is the most diverse movement I think we've ever seen. And this one's being really led by the environmental justice community. So many of the people that you were writing about in your new volume, and it'll have huge faith components. For the first time, labor seriously involved. It's going to be spectacular. I can't wait. I'm incredibly glad I don't have to go off and stand someplace and give a talk, because I'm looking forward to just watching everybody marching and marching with them.
You know, we see the slogan at rallies these days, climate rallies: we need a system change, not climate change. Naomi Klein's new book this week, Capitalism Versus the Climate. What does that mean to you?
People have got to read Naomi's new book. It's really terrific. What it means is, we all changed our light bulbs, and that was a good thing to do, but that's not going to stop climate change. Climate change is structurally embedded in the world we've got right now. It's a world where the richest companies on Earth, the fossil fuel industry, the 1% of the 1%, are allowed to use the atmosphere as an open sewer into which they get to dump their crap for free. This is not something we have to do. There was a huge study by the World's Economists that came out on Monday saying that we could, you read it in the New York Times, saying that we could change over to a non-fossil economy over the next few decades by changing what we invest in, and the net cost of that transition would be zero. It wouldn't cost us a thing. But it would cost the Koch brothers a lot, and it would cost the coal mining industry a lot, and these guys have so much money that they've been able to buy up our political system and keep it from changing. And since we're never going to have that money, we better find something else to use. I think our bodies are the main asset we have, and that's why we're marching.
You've seen in Vermont some of the challenges with folks who may not be big fans of petroleum-based resources, but they're also not fans of wind power, solar power, and other alternatives. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, I understand why people don't like doing anything, and I understand the kind of Vermont, sometimes the impulse of some Vermonters to say, I don't want anything ever to change in my place. But most Vermonters, by every survey I've seen, are eager to get on with renewable energy. We got to, because if we don't, believe it for sure, it's coming out of somebody else's hide. The parts of this country where the mountains are being ripped apart for coal, the parts of the far north where rivers are being changed in their direction for hydro, but the parts of the world where rising oceans are taking people's very nations away, the places around the globe where people are suffering unbelievably. Look at the pictures from Pakistan and Kashmir this week, where for 4 of the last 5 years there's been record flooding, and this year's is one of the worst. People have lost everything in events that make even our horror at Irene look small. We got to do what we can, and we got to do it fast.
Vermont's been an incubator of ideas on a lot of things, from marriage equality to environmental stuff. What would you like to see Vermont doing to lead the way on climate change?
Well, Vermont's been a great incubator of this climate movement. That's where this, march came from. the line of, pretty easy to trace the growth of this climate movement from that first climate march in the western edge of Vermont in Labor Day 2006, which by the time it reached Burlington after 5 days had 1,000 people and was the largest climate demonstration that had yet taken place in this country at that time. There are going to be 200, 300 times as many people in New York on Sunday, and it'll be the largest demonstration in the world, but there'll be a bunch of Vermonters, and they'll know that that's, the source of an awful lot of that history. We need a lot more of that from people in Vermont, and we need a lot of the beautiful work that everybody's doing to develop local economies and local energy sources and all the things that allow us to stand on our own feet and not wreck the planet and not wreck other people's lives. And Vermonters have been supplying those. We just have to do it on a bigger scale, just as fast as we can. I mean, there's specific things that, need to happen in Vermont. The most important thing that could happen right now, and by far the easiest, would be for the state to take a leadership role in divesting its funds from the fossil fuel companies. We're invested in the companies that are wrecking this planet, and it's truly, truly sad to see the state treasurer, Beth Pearce, and the governor unwilling to take that on. Their predecessors in the apartheid time exercised real leadership. Vermont was a leader in divesting from those funds, but these guys are just mouthing the by now very tired excuse that we're going to engage with the oil companies. The big oil companies in the last few years have sold off all their renewable energy divisions. Chevron finished just last week selling off its renewable energy divisions. Chevron gave the largest single corporate campaign contribution in history 2 weeks before the last election. If Vermont's pension fund holds Chevron stock, that's what we're about in this state, and I think it should stop, and I think a lot of people think it should stop.
Well, finally, Bill, and we'll let you go here because I know you've got a lot of things queued up in the way to working on this march. If you take a moment to kind of close your eyes and fantasize about how we turn the Titanic, what would that script look like?
David, I wish I knew how it went. I'm not prophet enough to know exactly how it goes. I know what the world looks like on the other end. It looks like what Germany's starting to look like, with renewable generation everywhere. And I can tell you what the mechanisms we are need that will get us there, a price on carbon and things. But I'm not capable of figuring out all the dimensions. All we're capable of as activists, I think, is trying to add pressure to this system, as much pressure as we can, so that the people who run it, the political leaders who run it, have to try and release that pressure by doing some of the right things. So to use a metaphor from our fossil fuel age, all of us down here are standing in the boiler room just shoveling coal in as fast as we can, building up pressure as fast as we can. We've got to, because we need real, real leadership. We see some of it in Vermont and some of it in Montpelier, but even in Montpelier we don't see enough, and you can be sure that if it's not happening, if people in Montpelier aren't doing all they can, like divesting, then political leaders around the rest of the world are doing next to nothing.
Okay, well, Bill McKibben, always great to have you on the Vermont Conversation, and we'll see you in New York this weekend.
God bless, brother. Take care.
Okay. Well, we had a chance to talk to Governor Peter Shumlin, who is also going to the People's Climate March this weekend, to talk to him about the march, what Vermont's doing, and the issue that Bill McKibben raises about fossil fuel divestment. My first question to Governor Shumlin was why he's going to the People's Climate March in New York this Sunday.
Well, you know, I think Vermonters agree that there really is no greater responsibility that we have than to move much more quickly than we have been getting off our addiction to oil and ensuring that we're moving to renewables and energy efficiency so that our kids and grandkids have a livable planet. And when I see the changes that have happened in Vermont just in my lifetime, it's absolutely startling. So we know that we're moving way too slowly. We know this is the most important issue that we're facing, and I'd want to be a part of it.
What do you think the rest of the world can learn from Vermont about dealing with climate change?
You know, I think one of the things we sometimes forget is that whenever there's a major transformation like this, whether it's, you know, in the Industrial Revolution where we learned how to really produce things in mass quantities, or whether it's the tech boom where we move technology to economic security and job creation, there's actually an opportunity here. It's not all doom and gloom. It's doom and gloom for the planet if we don't move quickly. There's jobs and economic opportunity if we do. And Vermont's proving that. When we go out and build out renewables, do energy efficiency, those aren't jobs that can be exported to India or China. We now have one of the lower unemployment rates in America. And one of the reasons is, and there's lots of reasons, but one of them is we are leading on green, clean, renewable energy jobs.
Around the country, climate change, you're visiting governors and your role is with the Democratic Governors Association. People are in hot political races. Climate change doesn't seem to be a big hot issue that moves people. Why not?
The oil industry has extraordinary power in this country. Don't ever forget it, as do all the industries that are dependent upon the oil industry. And they're very powerful. They've got a lot of money, very deep pockets. And in many of the states across this country, you know, their economy is dependent right now on the extraction of oil in some form or another. And, you know, what hasn't occurred to many of them is that may be true, but this planet will be unlivable if we keep doing what we're doing. And there's also economic opportunity, jobs, innovation in renewables.
So you know a lot of these governors and public officials who are involved in these races. We've had Superstorm Sandy wipe out New Jersey. We've had wildfires and droughts in California, and on and on and on. Record extreme weather events. How can these folks who are out there continue to basically put their head in the sand around these issues?
I'm as puzzled by that as anybody. What I know is that, you know, the brutal truth is that as climate change has even more of an adverse impact. You know, these Tropical Storm Irene, Tropical Storm Sandy, the forest fires that my western governors are constantly fighting, that's just a little bit of a warning sign for what lies ahead. And, you know, eventually the American people are going to say, listen, you know, we live in a society, in a planet that clearly isn't sustainable. We've got to change our ways, and they're going to force the politicians to move.
What do you think the key things that Vermont is doing to adapt or deal with climate change?
Well, I think the first thing is having really clear goals. You can't get anywhere if you don't know where you're going. My team got together and said, listen, we need an energy plan that matters. We're going to be 90% renewable by 2050. We're going to use less power, less oil than we're using now, and ensure that we're moving this state to a green, clean, renewable energy future that puts dollars in Vermonters' pockets while we do it, saves us money. So, you know, I think having a really clear goal and then getting there, and frankly, continuing in an environment nationally where politicians don't want to talk about this, to raise your voice, to show up at marches, to do all the things that we should be doing to raise the alarm.
So you were part of a White House task force on climate change. What was your message to President Obama, and what did he actually do in terms of implementing some of the recommendations that you've given to him?
One of the things that gives me a lot of hope is that when I see how President Obama has evolved in his 6 years in office on the issue of climate change, it's striking. I think he would tell you that while he was aware of it and he was concerned about it, it wasn't central to everything that he was doing when he started out. He truly believes in his heart that for his daughters, that for future generations, that he doesn't want to leave the presidency not having been the president who takes a firm stand on climate change. He's extraordinarily frustrated that he has a House of Representatives that doesn't believe in climate change. The majority doesn't believe in climate change. And he's trying to do everything he can with governors, with mayors, with local communities, with rulemaking, with the federal government, to do what he can to push the envelope before he's done. And he really means it. So I don't really have to tell the president anything. He gets this one, and he very much wants to make an impact and a difference before he leaves. The emission standards that he put in place just a couple of months ago is going to make a difference. Suddenly, the South and the folks that have been eating up the Northeast jobs for years because they have cheap, dirty power are going to have to clean up their power grid, stop burning coal and oil and the other things that they're doing, or if they do so at a much higher cost. And that's going to make a difference for all of us. So he's doing what he can to push the envelope. He's asking us to join him. And I think we're coming up with some ideas that are really going to be able to be advanced despite the inaction from Congress.
So right here in Vermont, the issue of bringing renewables in the form of wind, in the form of natural gas, has met with mixed response from some of the people in those communities. What do you say to people there who are concerned about the really local impacts of renewables in their community?
Well, first of all, in fairness to those who say, listen, I'm for renewables, I just don't want to see it, I don't want it to be in my life. This is a huge change for us. I mean, you know, as a kid, power for all of us was kind of out there somewhere. It was generated up at Hydro-Quebec or down at Vermont Yankee or far away somewhere. We didn't see it. As we move to a totally new transformation of power, and I'm convinced this is going to happen, where it's not so much poles and wires, but it's local generation in your own community with your neighbors, you're going to see the solar panels, you're going to see whatever it's generating the juice, and it's a real transformation. So it's understandable that people go, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure I like this, or this is going to take me a while to get used to. So I think what we need to do in Vermont to meet our goal and to continue to build out renewables is have a process that has a robust discussion so that communities, individuals feel like they're being heard, their concerns are listened to, and we still don't slow down, but we find ways to mitigate impacts so that people aren't finding their quality of life compromised by this transfer.
Bill McKibben has called for Vermont to divest its fossil fuel holdings in its what is your response to that?
Well, you know, we've looked at it. I actually think it's an intriguing idea. As you know, the treasurer has looked at it as well. And, you know, I think that over time we'll find ways that we can be more active in that effort. I would like us to be. As you probably know, we have a fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers to ensure that, you know, we're getting a good return on investment. So it's going to take some time to make the transformation, but I think it's a good idea.
Finally, what will the Vermont of 50 years from now look like that's different from what we see around us in the way of renewable energy?
If we do our job, you will see solar, and of course there's going to be huge technological advancements, but solar, wind, everything that we have as natural resources right now being harnessed in a thoughtful and very active way. And I think you're going to, you know, the big debate coming up in the next 10, 15 years, you know, looking forward, if I were to predict, will be the fight over who's going to pay for all the stranded cost of poles and wires. An electricity line into your home may be as obsolete as the copper line for your telephone.
Okay, well, that was, we had a little abrupt cutoff there of Governor Peter Shumlin as he was finishing up his remarks. We'll be back with more on the Vermont Conversation, talking with other leaders about efforts to stop climate change in advance of the People's Climate March this Sunday in New York City.
always on time signs and designs can help put your business image before the public with cost-efficient signs, banners, vehicle lettering, and even full vehicle wraps. They work with your budget, and like their name says, they deliver on time every time. Let's hear from Tom Beardsley, Vice President of Sales at the Radio Vermont Group.
Here at the Radio Vermont Group, when we need banners, oftentimes we need them right away. So I call the guys at Always On Time Signs and Designs and tell them what I'm looking for. The turnaround is quick, the prices are right, the quality is outstanding. So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend to anyone, if you need banners, signage of any kind for any event, for promoting your business or whatever, give them a call. Always On Time Signs and Designs. They really are great. We've had a great experience with them.
Call Always On Time Signs and Designs at 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808 for a free client consultation. Located at 115 Industrial Lane in Berlin, Always On Time Signs and Designs, 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808.
And a reminder, coming up this evening at 6:20, we'll join up with the Boston Red Sox in Pittsburgh. They'll take on the Pirates. 6:20 for the pregame, 7:05 for the first pitch. Right now it's time for World and National News Update.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. President Obama, on a visit to Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, promises the troops he has no intention of sending U.S. ground forces into combat in Iraq or Syria.
One of the things we've learned over this last decade is America can make a decisive difference. But I want to be clear, the American forces that have been deployed to Iraq do not and will not have a combat mission.
Obama adds the U.S. can provide air power, support, and training, but the nations in the Middle East will have to share the bulk of the fighting on the ground with Iraqi troops and local militias.
It is more effective to use our unique capabilities in support of partners on the ground so they can secure their own country's futures. And that's the only solution that will succeed over the long term.
The House is readying to vote, possibly today, on the president's request for authority and funding to equip and train Syrian opposition fighters to take on the Islamic group inside that country. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
The top drivers of the American-Canadian Tour roll into New Hampshire Motor Speedway Saturday for the Bond Auto ACT Invitational. Late model stars Joey Pohl, Patrick LaPerle, Brian Hoare, and Nick Sweet headline a field of 43 cars and stars ready to battle for the checkers at the Magic Mile. Join us for live coverage of the 6th annual Bond Auto ACT Invitational Saturday afternoon at 4:15 on your racing station, WDEV FM and AM, streaming live at WDEVradio.com.
This is Lee Cattell. This week, I'm driving Dan Keene's personal car, a Ford Fusion Energy full-size luxury sedan. Plug it into any household outlet at night and get the equivalent of 100 miles per gallon. If your daily commute is under 24 miles, you could use no gas, and there's much more. This Friday, I'll be at Lamoille Valley Ford. Dan Keene and his crew will answer my questions about this amazing new proven technology. This Friday, 7 to 9 at Lamoille Valley Ford in Hardwick.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. You can hear this show and all past shows at vermontconversation.com. And just a note about an upcoming event on September 26th at 7 p.m. at the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center. We'll be holding the third Vermont Town Hall. That's a public conversation series. This topic this time will be, Can Business Be a Force for Good? The event is co-sponsored by VBSR, and it features Jeffrey Hollander, the founder of Seventh Generation, and Toms of Maine. Tom Chappell, the founder of Toms of Maine, will both be addressing this question. I'll be moderating the event. Again, that's September 26th at 7 p.m., and you can go to sprucepeakarts.org for tickets and more info. We'll return now to our look at climate change. And in advance of the People's Climate March this Sunday in New York, which promises to be, according to Bill McKibben, the largest climate march in human history, Not to be too hyperbolic about it, but it will certainly be big. Thousands of Vermonters and others are going. So in our second half hour, we're going to look at two other faces of the movement to stop climate change. First, we're going to look at the issue of divestment from fossil fuel stocks. The fossil fuel divestment campaign has gained traction very quickly. As of this year, over 300 college campuses had divestment groups, and universities like Stanford have begun divesting as well. Other large institutional investors, including the $264 billion California Public Employees Retirement System, have launched initiatives aimed at reducing their fossil fuel investments and pressuring companies to clean up their acts. And numerous cities, including Seattle, Oakland, Portland, Cambridge, San Francisco, and Santa Monica, have divested all or part of their stock portfolios of fossil fuel companies. Well, one of the first colleges to announce that it was divesting its stocks was Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts. I spoke with the president of Hampshire College, Jonathan Lash, who also happens to be the former Secretary of Natural Resources here when Governor Madeleine Cunin was governor. So I asked Jonathan Lash why Hampshire decided to divest. Here's what he said.
The story is a little more complicated because the college had begun to review its investment policies 3 or 4 years ago. And the board made a decision that as an educational institution, we should align our investment policies with our mission and values, and decided to affirmatively invest in stocks of companies whose products and processes were consistent with Hampshire's mission and values. That meant that by the time Bill McKibben was speaking here and asked when were we going to divest, my answer was, well, really we can't because we don't hold fossil fuel stocks because we've already decided to invest in things that are more consistent with what we teach and believe. So, in effect, we had divested, and the students were very happy about that and have taken off using that as an opportunity for leadership.
What's been the impact of Hampshire College divesting?
It was fascinating. We were deluged with calls and emails from other schools, from towns, from small organizations expressing interest in how we reached the decision, how did we go through the process of changing our investments, what was the economic risk, and so forth. In fact, we were contacted by so many different organizations that the chair of our investment committee said, you know, we ought to hold a conference on this. And so with the organization Second Nature, we organized a conference last spring to provide an opportunity for leaders at higher education institutions and foundations and nonprofit groups to just discuss the why and how. And that was a lot of fun.
Have other colleges or institutions followed Hampshire's lead that you know of, you know, citing Hampshire's divestment as a reason?
I don't know the answer to that. I think every college makes its own decision based on its own values. I think that's important for them, and the discussion on campus about what to do is a fabulous teaching opportunity. But certainly other colleges have found our policy, our experience working with investment advisors, and so forth, instructive. And our students have worked with the students on other campuses to urge them to organize and seek a dialogue on their own campus.
Has there been any downside to divesting?
Boy, not so far. The performance of our very small $40 million endowment was above average last year for schools of our size. Sense of our campus was it was very important that we be acting on our beliefs, not only with regard to what we teach, but also how we invest. And it's been great working with other schools.
Just after Labor Day, Yale University President Peter Salovey announced that Yale would not divest from fossil fuels, following on the heels of other Ivy League schools, where no Ivy League school has divested from fossil fuel companies to date, although Stanford voted to divest from coal companies. And Harvard President Drew Frost has probably been the most outspoken on this when she wrote that, quote, "The endowment is a resource, not an instrument to impel social or political change, and that significantly constraining investment options risks significantly constraining investment returns." What is your response to your colleagues, your fellow university presidents, who are digging in against divestment?
Well, I can speak for Hampshire. We looked very closely at the economic implications, and we thought a lot about this proposition that investment is basically in a separate category from any other decision the school makes. And with regard to that latter point, we make many financial decisions where no one would question our values should apply in terms of wages and benefits and the kinds of buildings that we build on campus. So our trustees found it unpersuasive that there was just one kind of financial decision that should be exempt. They also felt, our students spend 5% of their time in class and the other 95% at the school but not in class. And all of their experience is part of the learning. We're a nonprofit organization exactly because we have a purpose. So the deal with the state and federal government is we don't pay taxes because our organization is dedicated to a higher purpose, and we feel that purpose should be consistent in everything we do. There's also a lot of evidence to suggest that fossil fuel investments carry significant risks. There's a lot of data coming out of the investment industry suggesting that there's a very significant downside. That had played a big part in Stanford's decision. And significant evidence that funds that are invested with constraints are doing quite reasonably well over extended periods of time. So at least for Hampshire, we found those arguments unpersuasive.
What's your advice to students and alumni around the country who are trying to pressure their universities to divest, but often meeting pretty significant resistance?
Well, of course, this process is a fabulous process. It is an opportunity for people to engage right at home around an issue that sometimes seems so big that it's impossible to get your hands on it. And the schools that have decided to open up the question and say, well, we're not sure what we want to do, but we recognize our students and our alumni are raising a serious question, have found that enormously productive. Some have not decided to invest, but have begun to run experiments with a percentage of their endowment in some sort of investment strategy that involves their values. I think schools should do that even if they're not going to divest. I think it is part of our role in society to allow issues to be openly discussed.
That was Jonathan Lash, the president of Hampshire College, which in the last couple of years is one of the first colleges in the United States to divest its endowment of fossil fuel holdings. Jonathan Lash was also the Secretary of Natural Resources in Vermont under former Governor Madeline Cunin. You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. This week's show is a focus on climate change. And now we turn north of the border. In Canada, there has been an enormous movement around the issue of extracting tar sands from Alberta in Western Canada. The Keystone XL pipeline, which has spawned numerous protests at the White House and beyond, a number of them led by Bill McKibben, who we had on earlier in the hour, lies within Western Canada, and specifically, it lies on the lands of Native peoples. At the beginning of this summer, there was the fifth annual Healing Walk, which was led by Native people of Canada through the area of the tar sands country. And it was described in very graphic terms by Clayton Thomas Mueller. He is a Native Canadian who works with the group Idle No More and is now co-director of the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign of the Polaris Institute. I spoke with Clayton Thomas Mueller just this morning about the Healing Walk and the work that he's doing around stopping tar sands extraction and other resource extraction from Native lands. And I asked him about the experience earlier this summer of walking through the area of the tar sands and what he saw and the work that he's now doing.
Well, unfortunately, I think the state of affairs in Cree and Dene territory in northern Alberta, where the tar sands exist, is much of the same business as usual. You know, while high-profile campaigns like the Keystone XL campaign in the Lower 48 and the quickly gaining prominence Energy East campaign here in eastern Canada gains visibility, we have to always keep in mind that there are already 6 million barrels of production per day of oil or bitumen, already rubber stamped, signed, sealed, and delivered, ready to go to market. I think that, you know, the benefit that we have on our side as social movements challenging the agenda of big oil in the tar sands is that right now they're producing about, you know, 1.8 to 2 million barrels per day, and we've effectively landlocked or turned the tar sands into a stranded economic asset, making it even more risky to international investment. And that, you know, is thanks in part due to the fact that, you know, these pipeline campaigns have reinvigorated and become the lightning rod of, you know, the U.S. environmental climate movement and also here in Canada. But we have a lot of work to do supporting First Nations in northern Alberta to stop this beast at the source, because, you know, like I said, there's already 4 million barrels ready to go, and they need every single one of these half a dozen or so pipelines and every single oil by rail car that they can gain access to achieve their ambitions.
As you walk through the tar sands country, what do you see as the impact on the Native communities there?
Well, I think that the impact, you know, really has to be, you know, perceived and understood as one of extreme violence. You know, today's economic policies that the Harper government are pushing, in particular around its, you know, $650 billion economic action plan, disproportionately impact First Nations, Inuit, and Métis communities, you know, Canada's Aboriginal peoples. The majority of Canadians live within 100 kilometers of the U.S. border. And the rest of Canada, you know, of course, is traditional Indigenous peoples land and, you know, populated sparsely by our Indigenous communities. And so, you know, the economic drivers of the Canadian economy, of course, are extractive industries. And, you know, it's no different in the tar sands. And, you know, the ecological footprint of this development, you know, can be compared to the a scale of the size of the country of England and Wales combined, or, you know, the state of Florida. And the Cree and Dene people in that territory have seen, you know, land that they've subsisted off of for time immemorial just be completely destroyed by this industry sector. You know, Canada is now leading the world. They've surpassed Brazil as far as, you know, deforestation. And we're seeing, you know, the boreal forest, one of the last remaining intact tracts of forest, a critical carbon sink for the planet, for planetary health in the context of climate change, being completely ravaged by big oil companies operating in the tar sands. And so, you know, indigenous peoples are greatly concerned about the forest. They're greatly concerned about the huge impacts on the water sources in northern Alberta, particularly the Athabasca River and Lake Athabasca, where the community of Fort Chipewyan, you know, is nestled comfortably on the shore of. You know, communities have seen rates of cancer skyrocket along the side of the trajectory of the expansion of the tar sands. And this is intimately connected to the fact that many of these communities in northern Alberta continue to subsidize their diet, you know, upwards of 80% on hunting and fishing practices. So the bioregional contamination in northern Alberta has just been incredibly immense. And the science, independent science commissioned by locally impacted communities, is finally starting to prove that.
I know you're about to board a flight to come to New York for the People's Climate March. What is the message that you bring from the Native people of Canada as you come to the march in New York?
Well, I think it's one of, most certainly of international solidarity. You know, Indigenous peoples in Canada are greatly concerned about the conversations that are happening by world leaders in both the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples, or as we're referencing it, the World Con. And we're also very concerned about the, you know, the conversations happening at the Global Climate Summit that Ban Ki-moon has called in preparation for Paris next year, the Paris COP. You know, I think there's shared concern about the voluntary technological and voluntary market fixes that global leaders are putting on the table, and the lack of any kind of legally binding mechanisms or enforceable mechanisms to actually force fossil fuel corporations and the countries like the United States and Europe and other, you know, big climate criminal governments that, you know, to force them to comply with the grim realities, you know, that the IPCC has been letting us know for the last decade. I think that Indigenous peoples, you know, being on the front line, you know, whether it's in Canada and Canada's tar sands, or in El Zapotec, Atlantic Canada, fighting against fracking, or, you know, in the global south where communities are seeing their forests privatized by the World Bank for, you know, carbon trading schemes like the REDS initiative. All of these market mechanisms are intimately connected, and, you know, the people that pay the greatest cost in terms of loss of access to traditional lands and hunting and fishing access, water, of course, end up being land-dependent people, forest-dependent people, indigenous peoples. And so we're greatly concerned and are bringing a message of solidarity with indigenous peoples across the world. And we plan on sending a very direct message along with the hundreds of thousands of people that are converging on the 21st at the world's biggest climate march right there in Manhattan. And indigenous peoples will be leading the march. And we'll be there in numbers. We'll be there in our regalia. We'll have our drums. We'll be singing our spiritual songs, connecting all of us to the sacredness of Mother Earth, and, you know, sending a very clear message, in particular to President Obama, that we need meaningful action on climate change right now.
You have a view that very few people have had, actually seeing the devastation of the lands, you know, of your communities. What gives you hope that you can stop this?
Well, I think that, you know, we have demonstrated the power of numbers, the power of social movement change theory. You know, over the last decade, we've invested a tremendous amount of time in convergent spaces like the power shift movement, the emerging global fossil fuel divestment movement, which has taken root in campuses all across North America. And we've introduced young people, youth, in particular, to the struggle and more importantly to the resiliency of frontline environmental justice communities and indigenous communities, and politicize them to take action. And I think the hope that I feel today is that we're winning this fight. You know, we're stopping the expansion of the tar sands by holding at bay infrastructure spiraling out of this fossil fuel monster in Alberta. And, you know, I think that young people in the movement, the climate justice movement, are fundamentally understanding now that, you know, if we don't organize our strategies and tactics in a way that throws a wrench in the economic drivers of our economy, like the tar sands, if we don't disrupt business as usual, if we don't disrupt commerce, then our strategies aren't going to be effective. And we're seeing the emergence of that kind of awakening, that kind of understanding, and the embracement of civil disobedience, direct action tactics that actually stop, you know, these types of harmful developments from occurring. And, you know, we'll certainly see elements of that, you know, right after the People's Climate March, when, you know, tens of thousands of people break off from the march and flood Wall Street and shut down Wall Street on Saturday as well.
That was Clayton Thomas Mueller, a native Canadian who works with the group Idle No More and is now co-director of the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. I spoke to him this morning just before he boarded a flight to come to New York, where he'll be helping to lead the People's Climate March on Sunday. A couple of articles of note that I read just this week in the New York Times. One was a lengthy article about Germany's renewable fuel system, where a remarkable portion of their fuel comes from both solar and wind. There were photos of these vast fields in the ocean of sea-based wind power generators. And the other was just yesterday, a major study that revealed that actually switching to renewable fuel, to a non-petroleum-based economy, would, in the long term, have zero cost. So we're now seeing some of the kind of intellectual infrastructure being put in place to what a transition to an economy in a world that did not alter the climate would both look like and cost, and in the case of Germany, how it actually works on the ground. There was an article that's now making the rounds called Why We March. It was we began our show with Bill McKibben, and Bill was one of the co-authors of this article. And it's worth quoting, as many Vermonters are about to board buses and cars to go to the climate march in New York. McKibben and others write, quote, "We're tired of winning the argument and losing the fight, and so we march. We march for the beaches and the barrios. We march for summers when the cool breeze still comes down in the evening. We march because Exxon spends $100 million every day looking for more hydrocarbons, even though scientists tell us we already have far more in our reserves than we can safely burn. We march for those too weak from dengue fever and malaria to make the journey. We march because California has lost 63 trillion gallons of groundwater to the fierce drought that won't end, and because the glaciers at the roof of Asia are disappearing. We march because researchers told the world in April that the West Antarctic ice sheet has begun to melt irrevocably. Greenland's ice sheet may soon follow suit, and the waters from those as rising seas will sooner or later drown the world's coastlines and many of its great cities. We don't march because there's any guarantee it will work. If you're a betting person, perhaps you'd say we only have a modest hope of beating it. There's a world to march for and a future, too. The only real question is why anyone wouldn't march." That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next week at 1. You can hear this and other shows at VermontConversation.com. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and their some 750 members, along with additional support from National Life Insurance for over 150 years, Working for a better tomorrow, Fairpoint. Small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By The Alchemist, serving Greater Waterbury since 2003. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And Green Mountain Power, all partnering with customers to promote clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. Join us next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Vermont Conversations with David Goodman.
Locally owned and operated, 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier.
President Obama restates his promise that U.S. ground...